From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. On this edition of Fresh Air, we try a fresh look at a very old problem. Historian Charles Smith joins us to explain the roots of the Arab-Israeli conflict. We also look at police brutality in America. Ron Hampton of the National Black Police Association gives us his view of the police assault in Los Angeles. And television critic David Bianculli reviews two new offerings from Public TV's American Playhouse series. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. ambassador to Iraq told a Senate committee today that Saddam Hussein lied to her about his plans to invade Kuwait. Ambassador April Glaspie said that she personally delivered a strong warning to Saddam that the U.S. would react vigorously if Iraq took military action against Kuwait or the United Arab Emirates. Glaspie said that Saddam was taken aback by the strength of the warning and was unusually conciliatory. She said the apparent accommodation was deliberate deception on a major scale. Before the Gulf War, Iraq released what it said was a transcript of Glaspie's meeting with Saddam, in which she apparently did nothing to discourage an invasion. A U.S. warplane shot down an Iraqi fighter jet over Saddam Hussein's hometown today. U.S. officials say the incident was not a resumption of hostilities between the U.S. and Iraq. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The U.S. Central Command said two Iraqi jets took to the skies today. One was shot down, the other landed on its own. A CENTCOM statement said the Iraqi attempt to fly the two fighter aircraft was a violation of terms agreed to between U.S. and Iraqi military officials. President Bush, in a photo opportunity with Polish President Lech Wałęsa, said he did not think the incident would be repeated.
One of the Iraqi planes violated the agreement. And it was shot down. Other planes violate the agreement, they will be shot down. I don't think that's likely to happen.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater downplayed the incident. We're not resuming hostilities, he said. We're not re-engaging. We're simply proceeding with the ceasefire as we outlined it to the Iraqis. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
President Bush welcomed Polish President Lech Wałęsa today with news the United States will forgive 70% of the debt Poland owes to the United States government. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
The president's announcement expands on a decision taken last week by the U.S. and other Western nations to reward Poland's efforts at reform by reducing its debt by half. Announcing the U.S. decision today to go even further, the president encouraged Poland's other creditors to follow suit. The U.S. share of Poland's debt is small, $3 billion of the $33 billion Poland owes governments. In addition, Poland owes other creditors another $15 billion. Saying, "We want your economic transition to succeed," Bush told Wałęsa he will ask Congress to increase next year's assistance grant to $470 million and encourage American businesses to invest in Poland. Today, though, Wałęsa said the president offers a great new possibility for his country. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points today to close at 2,872. Advances led to declines by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 197 million shares. This is NPR News. The White House criticized the Kuwaiti government today for shutting down a newspaper that accused the government of incompetence in restoring basic services. The paper, called February 26th, was ordered to stop publishing after it ran a column criticizing the government for doing a poor job of restoring water, power, and other utilities. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the closing of newspapers was not a hopeful sign that the Kuwaiti government intends to move toward a more democratic society. The Senate today voted to cut off aid to Jordan, sending a clear message that it intends to punish King Hussein for supporting Iraq during the Persian Gulf War. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Senate voted to cancel $20 million of military assistance and $35 million in economic aid to Jordan. The aid cutoff was opposed by the Bush administration. President Bush temporarily suspended aid payments to Jordan on February 6th, but he wanted the flexibility of restoring the aid to Jordan in order to encourage that country to help the U.S. peace efforts in the region. Under the bill passed by the Senate today, economic aid to Jordan could be restored only if the president certified that Jordan was helping the peace process, and military aid could be restored only with specific congressional consent. The aid to Jordan was part of a bill financing costs related to the Persian Gulf War. The House has already passed a version of the bill without cutting off aid to Jordan. The matter will now be resolved in a House-Senate conference. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Five New York City police officers were indicted on murder charges today. A sergeant and four officers are accused of beating and choking a young car theft suspect to death last month. New York Mayor David Dinkins said today that he was deeply troubled by the allegations, which prompted the city's police commissioner to issue new guidelines on the use of force. The indictments come amid widespread concern over allegations of police brutality after Los Angeles police were videotaped kicking and beating an unarmed suspect. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Yesterday, Israel's Army Chief of Staff, Dan Shamron, unleashed a furor in the country when he said that Israel could safely give up land in the occupied territories in exchange for a peace agreement with its Arab neighbors. Immediately, some members of the Israeli cabinet called for his resignation, and others reaffirmed the government's absolute intransigence on any land for peace plan. The conflict between Arabs and Israelis is the longest, most visible conflict in this century, a seemingly unending battle to which American governments and news media continuously return. Today we want to step back a little, talk about who the players are, where they came from, and why this crisis seems almost incapable of resolution. Charles Smith is a Middle East historian at San Diego State University. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Charles Smith, is it fair to say that what we're looking at is two people who have valid deeds to the same piece of real estate?
I think we have to say that. We have to say that from their own perspectives, they assume that they have an absolute right to the land. But the claims go back, from the Zionist point of view, to the mid and late 19th century, whereas the Palestinian Arabs simply assumed because they were living in the land of Palestine had a right to be there. So they did not really formulate rights per se until Zionism, as a threat to them, claiming the right to take over the land they lived on, challenged their assumptions that they could live there.
What is Zionism? What is this notion of an Israeli state? Where does the idea that Jews in that part of the world needed a nation, where does that come from?
Well, Zionism, as the word Zion, harks back to the ancient kingdoms of Israel. But Zionism, in its modern context, is a secular, modern nationalist movement seeking to establish a state in Palestine, in the lands that were the former Kingdom of Israel, or the different kingdoms of Israel, in the pre-Christian era. And this was formed in Eastern Europe, most particularly in Russia, from the 1870s on by secular Jews who had left the religious habitat that dominated Jewish culture in Eastern Europe, but could not be assimilated into Russian culture at the time because of anti-Semitism. Consequently, they began to think that they should look elsewhere, and where better to look than where Jews had lived 2,000 years before. So this is really the first formulation of what we might call Zionism.
Well, isn't it related to the whole invention of the idea of a nation? I mean, the nations are a relatively new invention in the world, aren't they?
Exactly. Nationalism itself can really be traced to the French Revolution and then developments with this idea throughout the 19th century. So the Jews were adopting an idea for themselves that they should have a nation as Jews. Now, this idea, of course, was totally foreign to any non-Western culture of the time because they were living in what we would call traditional societies, which were quite viable with high levels of culture at times, but in which identity was on the basis of kinship or religion. But in which nations, in the modern nation-state sense, had never existed, and there was no reason for them to exist.
There were no Arab nations as such?
Not as such, no. There were people who thought of themselves as Arabs and identified as Arabs or as Muslims or as Christians or whatever. But a nation per se, as opposed to dynasties, great dynasties, had never existed, simply because this was not part of the cultural landscape.
Well, and isn't it also important to remember that not all Jews were sold on the idea of nationhood?
Well, this is very important. Zionism really got a tremendous push in the 1890s because of the Dreyfus case in France, anti-Semitic utterances, and Theodor Herzl writing his book Der Judenstaat, which then led to the formation of the World Zionist Organization in 1897. But even from that point onwards, Zionism was essentially limited to small groups of people, even in Eastern Europe. And in the Western world, Western Europe and America, Zionism really had very little support, even down until after World War I and into the 1920s and 1930s. It was only with the knowledge of Hitlerian Germany in the 1930s and the Holocaust that you begin to get massive mobilization and massive support for the Zionist movement in the Western world, particularly in the United States.
So if we're taking this model of two people, each of whom hold valid deeds to the same piece of territory, how do we get the boundaries of what is today Israel?
Well, I would question whether we can assume that everyone has valid deeds to the same territory. If we did that, then Arab Muslims would have a valid deed to Spain, since they control the area and lived there for over 700 years. The valid deeds is a Western legal concept, and I think we assume that both sides have valid legal deeds today simply because the situation is intractable. The Jewish claim, the Zionist claim, was based on residence 2,000 years before. The Palestinian Arab claim was based on the fact that they were living there. And the origins of the real conflict come once you have major Zionist immigration in the first decade of the century and open propaganda and claims that a Jewish state would be created. And at that time, you begin to get very open Palestinian-Arab resistance. But the true issue, as defined in Western terms, in terms of dividing up the land, really comes in World War I, with great power division of the Middle East and imperial spoils, and Zionism's alignment with Great Britain in as a hope of gaining Palestine. And they were successful in doing this through the Balfour Declaration of November 1917.
Well, what we saw was the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which had pretty much ruled that entire part of the world, right?
Right.
And so enter onto the scene Britain and France.
Enter Britain and France. Both had ambitions in the remaining lands of the Arab Middle East that had not been taken over by them in the period before World War I, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, etc. A ruler, a religious official in the Hejaz in Western Arabia, the Sharif Hussein of Mecca, had already been in contact with the British in Cairo, seeking total independence from Ottoman control. Now, out of this, there developed a correspondence with the British representative in Cairo, was called the Hussein McMahon correspondence, in which the Sharif Hussein claimed Arab independence after the war for all the lands of what we would call the Arab Middle East today, including Palestine. And he had every right to assume that Palestine would be included by the British because they had been dropping propaganda leaflets since late 1914 promising Arab independence, and they had specifically mentioned Palestine in these leaflets.
Now let's be clear, because most people don't know these details here.
Right.
The leaflets were being dropped
by plane and ship and distributed, right?
By the Western powers.
By Great Britain, out of Cairo. They were dropping these leaflets in Arabia. They were dropping them in Palestine and in Syria.
And there was an assumption that the Zionist purpose would be realized with some sort of state created, and that there would be some kind of state which would be home to the residents, to the Palestinians.
No, not at all. We have to correct this. The Zionist issue does not come up until 1917. This is earlier in the war in 1915, 1916. And at this time, you have this correspondence where the British exclude some territory from potential Arab independence after the war, but never mention Palestine. It is later claimed that they meant to do this. Perhaps they did, but they did not. And the Sharif Hussein assumed that Palestine was still included in the lands to be promised him. At the end of the war, the British intelligence analysts preparing summaries for the people going to the peace conference stated quite clearly that while the British did later in 1917 promise Palestine to the Zionist movement, they had also, if only implicitly, promised Palestine to the Arabs. And there were two conflicting promises that existed, and the question was, how are they going to resolve it?
And indeed, it was the strength of the Zionist movement that invented Israel in 1948, certainly not out of the benevolence of Britain.
Oh, not at all. You had a very strong military movement, a very able one, organized by the Zionists in Palestine. It was strong politically as well as militarily, whereas the Palestinian movement in Palestine was politically bereft of leadership and politically fragmented and had no military force to speak of whatsoever. You also had great motivation on the part of the Jews because of the knowledge of the Holocaust, in the sense that recent developments after World War I proved the claim that the Jews needed a state. The Palestinians actually seem to have assumed simply that because they were still in 1948 on the eve of the birth of Israel, double the size of the Jewish population and owned twice the land, that they had a right still to the whole area, and they refused to compromise. So when a partition plan was proposed in 1947, the Zionist movement accepted this because they would get at least part of Palestine as a state of Israel, and the Palestinian Arabs rejected it because it again was an outside force seeking to determine their fate.
My guest is Charles Smith. He is a Middle East historian at San Diego State University. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Historian Charles Smith is my guest. We're talking about the roots of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Israel was formed in 1948. The crisis didn't go away. And nobody really seemed fully secure in their control of the deed, as if we see this as a question of who has the deed to the territory. What are the seeds of the ongoing conflict that continued to be planted and harvested even up into the current Gulf War? How do we see how that construction of Israel affected the possibility of any resolution?
Well, I think we have to divide this period down to the Gulf War into two separate periods. One would be down to the 1967 war, and then the post-67 war period when Israel controls, at that time, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and all of the Sinai Peninsula. In the period before that, from 1948 to 1967, you have essentially an Arab state conflict and hostility with Israel, in which Arab states are, at least verbally, and sometimes through sanctions or blockades, in other ways aggressive towards Israel.
Well, they're the declared enemies of Israel, right?
They stated that Israel had no right to exist, and they refused to recognize them. And you had a continuing state of war through the fact that you had armistices. You never had settlements, even after 1948, because the agreements that were made were armistices or suspensions of hostility. Now, you also had Israeli efforts at times through preemptive strikes to take out people they deemed to be hostile to them and who might be potential threats. And so you had, for example, the 1956 Suez crisis in which Britain, France, and Israel attacked Egypt in the hope of overthrowing Gamal Abdel Nasser. Now, in the 1960s, Israel became the particular focus of what we might call intra-Arab hostility. Radical Arab nationalism, particularly fostered by Syria, challenging Nasser for leadership of the Arab world, with Israel being the whipping boy in between. Syria, in this process, began to encourage a radical Palestinian group called Al-Fatah, led by Yasser Arafat, to attack into Israel from Jordan. And this destabilization was aimed not only at Israel, but at Jordan, because King Hussein of Jordan was considered, in the language of the time, a feudal monarch who had to be overthrown. Now, this crisis, with the aid of Arafat and Al-Fatah, ultimately led to the outbreak of the 1967 war, because Nasser, responding to Arab criticism and insults that he was soft on Israel, you had a United Nations peacekeeping force in the Sinai as a buffer between him and Israel following the Suez Crisis of 1956, ousted the UN force and took over areas that had been used to blockade Israeli shipping in 1956. But this did not actually lead Israel to attack Egypt. Israel decided to attack Egypt once they knew that Nasser was seeking a peaceful way out. And Israeli politicians and military leaders in 1967 decided that Nasser should not be able to get away with the crisis that had ensued, and it would be a way also of destroying the military arsenal the Soviet supplied that Nasser had built up in the Sinai. This was a brilliant success, and when Jordan came in, Israel responded, took over East Jerusalem, the West Bank, etc., and the Golan Heights along with the Sinai Peninsula. And that established a new situation that in many ways has lasted to the present day, although, as you know, the Sinai Peninsula was returned to Egypt following the Camp David Accords and the Egyptian-Israeli Peace Agreement in 1978-1979. But a whole new period came in then with new attempts to define what might be the peace efforts and resolution that might ensue at some future date. And Security Council Resolution 242, passed in November of 1967, was to be the basis of that. And this has been interpreted in various ways by various parties ever since, because it denounces and renounces the idea that land should be controlled through force and calls for secure boundaries. At the same time, it states that Israel should return territories taken in the recent conflict, with the word "the" deliberately left out, so it would not have the idea that all the territories should be returned, particularly meaning, in this case, I think, the West Bank.
Right, now, and this is, of course, where we are today.
And this is where we are, with Israel claiming that those territories might be substantial, and the Arabs always claiming, with, by the way, the United States' assent in terms of their interpretation, that in general they expected Israel to give up most of the territories. Now, in terms of your opening remarks, you have also had a debate that has become increasingly intense in Israel in recent years over whether the territories, and particularly the West Bank, are absolutely crucial to the security of Israel. And military leaders such as Shomron have argued that they are not, that in terms of long-term security interests, peace might be more valuable to Israel than holding on to territory. The claims to hold on, particularly to the West Bank, are much more political and religious and supported by right-wing politicians who see these areas as Judea and Samaria, which is really where the original Jews came in the 13th and 12th centuries of the pre-Christian era.
So here we are. The Gulf War has happened. The Palestinians verbally chose to side themselves with Saddam Hussein, and in some sense of public relations, at least, seem to have their stock has declined, and the sympathy for them to some degree has been weathered on has been diminished. But on the other hand, we now see the U.S. in a position to push the Arab countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, conceivably Syria, into a different sort of relationship with Israel. And it's to what extent? How do you see the situation changed relative to finding some resolution, and how the alliances are going to form?
Well, this is a very difficult question, and I'm not sure that it's capable of resolution. You've suggested that the United States should push its Arab allies, and I think they will try to push them. But there's another side to this; they will have to push Israel as well. The basic question may be, will the United States be willing to push Israel with the same force or powers of suggestion that it will use on its Arab allies to seek to make compromises to resolve this issue? Now, in resolving this, they will have to deal with the Palestinian question. And from the Arab side, from the side of our Arab allies, whoever they are, there must be some sort of independent Palestinian entity on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Now, it may be connected to Jordan. It may even exclude the PLO. We don't know about that. It's rather interesting how the PLO can survive at times. There is certainly no great eagerness on the part of many of our allies, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait at this moment, to allow the PLO to have any role at all, and Israel has been absolutely adamant about this. But that does not exclude the Palestinians in the territories from having a voice, and many of them, whether they will say it or not openly or will be recognized by others, are aligned with the PLO. I think we have to look here at something the United States may be falling into a trap. In the spring of 1990, when there was increasing violence in the West Bank, and after an Israeli had killed four Palestinians in May, Arafat asked for a UN Security Council investigating team to go in to monitor the situation. 14 out of 15 members of the Security Council approved of that suggestion. The United States vetoed it. Then you had the crisis over the terrorist attack by Abu Abbas coming out of Baghdad, and later on the suspension of the dialogue with the PLO by President Bush on June 20th. In that speech, President Bush said something very interesting. He said he realized that his Arab allies, the most moderate Arab states, and his European allies disagreed with what he was doing. They disagreed with that judgment. They disagreed with the policy of the United States towards attempts to resolve the outstanding question of the Palestinians. And this is where I see, down the road, the possibility of the United States becoming isolated with Israel against its former allies in this Gulf crisis, precisely because we may try to control it unilaterally and be unwilling to respond to what I see as the real needs of the Palestinians in the territories, irrespective of the question of whether the PLO is leading them or not.
Well, let's look at what possible influence the U.S. might have toward Israel. I mean, what cards does the United States have? In fact, could Israel exist without U.S. money?
Absolutely not. $3 billion a year and now more. And as a matter of fact, we have just awarded them $650 million in war damages, and AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, came out and said that if sufficient money was not awarded, they would threaten to campaign against Republican candidates in the elections in 1992. So this is already a major lobbying issue from the point of view of Israel supporters in the United States. The only real impact the United States could ever have, and that is very doubtful in political terms, would be to reduce aid to Israel. And I frankly don't see that happening.
Well, what's in it for U.S. interests to maintain unflagging support of the Israeli position? After all, I mean, Israel for a very long time has argued that it is the United States' most reliable ally, both politically and militarily, in the Middle East. But here we have the first real military showdown in the Middle East with Iraq, and Israel played not only no military role at all in support of the U.S., we put Israel to the side and made our arrangements with the Arab countries. I mean, isn't the claim that Israel is the only reliable ally a little bit diminished now? So why should the Bush administration, why should one suppose the Bush administration is going to remain that deeply wed to Israel?
Well, I don't know. You've raised a very good point, because the argument that Israel was our most reliable ally had nothing to do with the region per se. It was what we call a globalist interpretation, in which Israel was an ally of the United States against Arab states supported by the Soviet Union. In other words, the importance of Israel as an ally to the United States was within a Cold War context. Now, the Gulf crisis has shown the more crucial aspects of regional issues, particularly with respect to the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, and the way that we have relied on Arab allies in order to resolve that. Now, obviously, this is a post-Cold War crisis, which presumably one would hope regional issues would become more important. In this context, Arab allies would appear to be much more important to the security and long-term interests of the United States than would Israel, in purely military terms. We should be committed, it seems to me, to the existence of Israel, but we should also be committed to peace in the region. And in that sense, Israeli policies as they stand at the moment seem rather inimical to the hope of peace in the region, because they no longer serve the military purposes that they did before, and I would question how important those military purposes were at various times.
My guest has been Middle East historian Charles Smith. He is on the faculty at San Diego State University, and he's also the author of Palestine and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Frank Browning with Fresh Air. Over the past couple of weeks, virtually all of America has seen that videotape of a group of white Los Angeles police officers beating up an unarmed black suspect. That footage has reopened long-standing issues of police racism and abuse of power. Coming up, we discuss those issues with Ron Hampton, the National Affairs Director of the National Black Police Association. Also this week, the public television series American Playhouse kicks off its 10th season with TV versions of two Broadway shows, Into the Woods and The Grapes of Wrath. TV critic David Biancooley reviews them both. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq at the start of the Persian Gulf War, spoke in public today for the first time since the invasion of Kuwait. Appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Ambassador Glaspie described a controversial meeting that she held with President Saddam Hussein a week before the Iraqi invasion. We have details from NPR's Neil Conan.
According to a transcript of that meeting released by Iraq last fall, Ambassador Glaspie told Saddam Hussein that the United States took no position on border disputes among Arab nations, a statement cited by some as a disastrous mistake, a green light for Saddam to go ahead with the attack. Today, Ambassador Glaspie said the Iraqi fabrication left off the opening half of her actual remark, which was that the United States insisted that Iraq's disputes with Kuwait be resolved without the use of violence or threats. Saddam, she said, surrendered and promised both her and President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, whom he spoke to by phone, that he would not use force against Kuwait. The way Ambassador Glaspie told it, there was no way that Saddam Hussein could have doubted U.S. resolve to defend Kuwait, and he gambled on his judgment that Arab countries would never allow American forces into the region. This is Neil Conan reporting.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has voted to cut off U.S. aid to Jordan because of its pro-Iraqi stance during the Persian Gulf War. The move opposed by the Bush administration would rescind a $20 million military assistance package and $35 million in economic aid that Jordan is to get this year. Opposition members in Kuwait are applauding the prime minister's move to seek the resignation of his government. The prime minister announced the cabinet reshuffle this morning amid mounting public criticism of the government's performance. From Kuwait City, NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
The prime minister, Sheikh Saad al-Abdullah al-Sabah, told reporters this morning that he plans to reshuffle his entire 22-member cabinet. The prime minister downplayed the move, saying it had been planned long in advance. It is quite normal, he said. But critics of the government said the prime minister was forced to seek the resignations because of mounting public pressures over the lack of progress in rebuilding the country and restoring basic services. Opposition members welcomed the move, saying the current cabinet is not qualified to deal with the present crisis. The prime minister is expected to announce the new cabinet in the coming days. I'm Deborah Wong in Kuwait City.
An official at the UN says Iraqi crops will most likely fail this year because of a lack of water for irrigation. Yesterday, the International Committee of the Red Cross warned of possible starvation in Iraq as some items, including flour, have become too expensive for most people. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 4 points to close at 2,872.03 in very active trading. This is NPR News. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has barred companies from banning women of childbearing age from certain hazardous jobs in a ruling that affects millions of working women. The court struck down a policy of a car battery manufacturer which excluded women who could not prove that they are sterile from jobs that expose them to lead. The High Court held that the so-called fetal protection policies violate civil rights laws that forbid discrimination against women. As many as 20 million female workers in various industry may be affected by the ruling. In New York City, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council are meeting this evening to review a draft resolution aimed at putting the finishing touches on the Persian Gulf War. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
According to a senior U.S. official, the proposal drafted by Washington will be a formal ceasefire, but not a peace treaty. The U.S. focuses on four main points. First, the disengagement of coalition troops and their replacement with UN peacekeepers. Second, finding a formula for Baghdad's repayment of damages to Kuwait. Third, the return of all Kuwaiti detainees being held in Iraq. And fourth, a probable end to the embargo on humanitarian supplies, such as food and water. Although the U.S. official says chemical weapons are not part of the original draft, Britain is expected to insist on language that would call for destruction of Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
A federal judge has fined Eastern Airlines $3.5 million for safety record violations at airports in New York and Atlanta. The judge approved an agreement reached between the grounded airline and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn, New York. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Black citizens in Los Angeles and other cities have claimed for years that what they receive from police officials is not protection, but brutality. Often, white Americans have dismissed such allegations as radical rhetoric. But the videotaped bludgeoning of Rodney King in L.A. 2 weeks ago has shown just how real police brutality can get. King's beating touched a nerve in minority communities throughout the nation, including among black police officers. My guest is Ronald Hampton, a 19-year police veteran who also serves as National Affairs Director of the National Black Police Association. Hampton says he is encouraged that Attorney General Richard Thornburg has promised a nationwide investigation of police brutality, but he doubts how serious that investigation will be.
We're in the process now of drafting up a letter to send to the Attorney General to ask him to meet with us, because we want to hear and we want to get some sense of his commitment to really doing this. Because, see, if he's going to be sincere and thorough, then I would suggest to you that he has to be prepared to somehow or another be able to divulge the dirty laundry of the criminal justice system to this public. And I don't think that they're ready to do that.
You've been, what, 19 years a police officer?
Yes, sir.
How much police brutality takes place in this country?
Quite a bit. And it seems to happen in the poor, black and brown communities in this country. And I don't think it's by accident that those are the communities where we have less power, less access to the kind of things that demand attention or demand the equality or the distribution of equal services across the country.
Well, how have you seen it? What is it that you've ever seen take place? Have you seen things happen similar to those that, similar to the beating that Rodney King got in Los Angeles?
No, and I'm glad that I've never seen it at that level, because if I had been on the scene at there, I would have pulled my service revolver and challenged the guys. And if they hadn't, I think I would have shot them, because that was just, I'm still trying to reconcile my anger now as a person that they would even do that to another human being, you know. But you see...
Now, let me get this straight. You're saying you would have shot one of your fellow officers if you had seen him doing that?
Oh, I would have pulled my service revolver. It would have been up to him whether or not he would have, you know, caused me to shoot him. That would have been something else. But see, you know, there are laws. There are laws in the code all over this country that says that police officers cannot witness a felony and not take a police action. And the police action is an arrest. And that was assault with a deadly weapon. So, sometimes I happen to believe in our organization that once you build a machine of destruction, that, you know, the time to stop it is to stop it from being built. Once it's built, then, you know, you have to do something drastically to draw the public's attention to this thing if it's gotten out of hand. And again, that's the extreme version. But the kind of things that go on every day are the casual violations of people's rights, if no more than the verbal abuse of a citizen who's entitled to be respected.
Now, what do you mean by verbal abuse? Have you seen such casual, ordinary, daily abuse by police?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you stop a citizen and you want his permit, or if someone stand on the corner and you walk up to him and say, you know, some police officers, they'll come up and say, "Hey, MF, you know, get off my GD corner, you know, and I want it right now." Well, you don't have to move, number one, because in our city, there's no anti-loitering laws, and you can't just talk to people and make them move. You can't demand any ID from them unless they happen to be driving a car, and that's a privilege. So they have to present their permit or license on demand. And normally we, the people in policing, tend to take on this God-like behavior once they put on this badge and uniform and carry a gun.
Officer Hampton, I want to ask you something. If these sorts of things are happening to black people and others in this country all the time, why are you as a black man still a police officer?
Because I happen to know that the only way they change is that change has to take place on the inside. That, you know, all of the pressure that citizen groups and citizens, goodwill, can put on a police department. Police departments in this country act as closed societies. They really resent outside influence. But the fact of the matter is that police serve the people.
But you've been an officer for 19 years. That's right. A long time to have served, and yet you still say these things are going on.
That's very true, because most change takes place in, you know, in spans of time probably less than the eye can see. And as we plug away at the kind of things that happen, I mean, even in our police department, 15 years ago, our police department was 37% black. Today, we stand with 66% of the police department. But the policies that set in place the police institution in this country, historically white, male-dominated Protestant organization, are still in effect. Middle management is still disproportionately white. Even though I have a black chief and some black executives in my department, the person who tell most of the people to work every day are white lieutenants and white sergeants. And they bring to the job their own personal prejudice and other things. And their own experiences that they come from these communities that some of them don't even have African-Americans who live in the community with them.
So are you saying that this sort of behavior takes place in the Washington, D.C. Police Department?
Oh, yeah. And Chief Foote would tell you that, that there are problems in our police department as it relates to how we treat people. And one of the other things that I think we have to be very careful about, see, now we're in our society, now we're going through this grip of crime. And, you know, and for some time now, our society has painted the picture of criminal as being this young black male between the ages of 16 and 25 who is out of control on our streets. And the police people in this country think that almost every black man between those ages are criminals. So consequently, they treat them as such. And that's what you have to be careful about. You can never give police in any society carte blanche to operate, because we move close to a police state. And I would suggest to you that we're close to a police state in this country today. Just because...
What do you mean by a police state?
Where police have total control, where they can do anything they want to do, and the public does not question what they do. I mean, the power that we have as police officers is given to us by citizens. That's where we get our power. We cannot do the things we do unless it was sanctioned by the people we serve. But you wouldn't believe that if you were to pay attention to the way some police officers act. They act as if the citizens are subservient to them, and that they're in charge.
My guest is Ron Hampton. He is the National Affairs Director for the National Black Police Association. We'll take a short break and be back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ron Hampton, National Affairs Director for the National Black Police Association. Ron, you have described what you call a near police state that you think exists in this country, especially for black people. What's going to happen when you go to work after this broadcast airs? What do people say to you when you make comments like that?
Well, see, I've been saying it for 19 years. And before the 19 years that I've spent on the, before I started my 19-year career in the police department, I was in the Air Force, and I used to talk like that in the Air Force because, I mean, there are just certain things that ought not happen that ought to take place just by virtue of the fact that we treat one another like we like to be treated. And I'm not really concerned about what my peers think, because I'm there to do a job, and the job that I'm there to do is to provide a service.
But you do have to work with them.
Oh, yeah, but they have to respect me, and that's all I require from them. They don't have to like me because I don't live with them. And they do respect me because I call it like I see it. But see, I would do that for anybody, whether they were black, yellow, green, or red. I wouldn't allow a police officer to abuse a white person. So you know I'm not going to allow them to abuse a black person. And I'm going to always call it the way I see it. Now, if they don't like that, then that's on them. But I'm not there to please anyone. I'm there to do a job. And everything that I do, I can go somewhere and pull it up out of a book and show you that that's the way I'm supposed to respond.
What has been the effect of this national attention to the police beating in Los Angeles? How is it going to affect your job as a law enforcement officer? How is it going to affect law enforcement in general?
Well, number one, I think it sets law enforcement back about 100, maybe 150 years, because one of the things that law enforcement agencies have tried to do over the last 10 years, I know for a fact, and that is try to create better and stronger relationships with the communities they serve. And what this piece of film has done is it has more or less made the community confident that you know, they have somehow, the community has been aware that abuse has taken place, sometimes small, sometimes large, sometimes in the middle, all along, because they've been the victim of it. But they have been reluctant to speak out about it because their complaints sort of get disregarded. And if you go to the police station, they don't really pay you any attention, you know. But now we have caught this incident on TV, and it has more or less brought to the front of the front burner, the issue of police abuse in this country, not just in Los Angeles, but in this country. And now people are saying, well, I've told you all along that it's happening.
When is the last time that you saw a fellow officer undertake a brutal act? And can you simply tell us the story? Can you recount an occasion that you witnessed brutality?
Oh, yeah. It was back in 1978 or 79. I was working in patrol section, and I happened to be in a car and respond to the scene where an individual had ran from the police. The call went out as someone was shooting crap. And so when we got there, the guy had ran. And obviously, you know, people run from the police. So when the police officer caught up with the guy, the officer grabbed him and said, you don't run from the police, and he hit him in the face. So
Was this man your partner?
No. He happened to be in another car by himself. I was riding by myself. And at that time, I said something to the officer about it, his behavior. So then they put the handcuffs on him and took him to the police station. So once the guy got to the police station, they handcuffed him in the back and was processing him to get out. And they was just going to charge him with shooting crap in public, which was about $10 at that time. But the officer kept taunting the individual. He kept pushing him. He kept cussing at him. A whole lot of unnecessary stuff. All you're supposed to do is take a person in, process him, and let him go. So the guy had paid his $10 and was on his way out the precinct. The officer kept taunting him and taunting him and taunting him while he was leaving. So then the officer pushed the guy from the back. The guy turned around and hit the officer. And I mean, he hit him real good in the face, almost knocked him down on the ground. So the people in the precinct there grabbed the guy, placed him under, you know, grabbed this, put the handcuffs on him again. The guy, at the same time he grabbed him in the back of the head, he pushed his head down. He took his right knee and kneed him in the chest.
The officer did this.
Right. So we have a policy where when an incident like that go down in the precinct, what they call APO, assault on police officer, every individual is supposed to write a letter describing what happened. So it was the sergeant who was in the station and witnessed it at that time was the official, and he asked everybody for a statement except for me. Now, you know, and I had a reputation on the job, because I came on doing what I thought was right. And I didn't hang in the pack, and I didn't smile and giggle with them. I did what I was supposed to do.
Well, did you file a report on your own?
No. Well, I wrote up a statement because I know what the policy says. So I wrote my statement, and I turned it into my sergeant. And he took it, and then he gave it to the other sergeant.
But was any action taken against the police officers?
No, wasn't no action taken against the police officer.
Still in all, this event that you witnessed was at least 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't suggest, surely, that the police brutality is a terribly common thing. Surely you would have seen something else besides that in the last 12 years if there were an enormous amount of police brutality in the Washington Police Department.
Oh, no. Well, see, what happens is that once you establish yourself as somebody who's not going to allow things to happen, then the word gets out about you. So those kind of things don't take place in front of you anymore. What I'm saying is, it's just like if you worked in the government and, you know, they call you whistleblowers. Well, at that point, they usually put you somewhere or they know that they can't do things around you. So you begin to set the tone. And see, that's why we say the change needs to take place internally. The officers of goodwill need to draw the line and say, I'm not going to do it, but I'm not even going to allow people to mistreat people. And then people won't do that in front of you.
Ron Hampton, what is your rank in the police department right now?
I'll give you one guess. I'm a police officer.
On the street.
Right.
Ronald Hampton is a police officer in Washington, D.C. He is also National Affairs Director of the National Black Police Association. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us from All Things Considered. What's on the program today, Noah?
Hi, Frank. Testimony on Capitol Hill. April Glaspie, the former ambassador to Iraq, appears before a Senate committee to explain her conversation with Saddam Hussein last summer in Baghdad. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade, Yugoslavia. It's a review of the history of ethnic conflict in that area between the countries that came together to make up Yugoslavia. Also, poetry from Charles Simic. He immigrated to this country from Yugoslavia in the 1950s. He continues to write about the wartime years in his homeland. And a report from Kuwait City, where Kuwaitis are said to be happy about the announced reorganization of the government.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week on PBS, American Playhouse begins its 10th season by televising two recent Tony-winning Broadway productions, the Stephen Sondheim James Lapine musical Into the Woods on Wednesday, and the stage version of John Steinbeck's drama The Grapes of Wrath on Friday. TV critic David Bianculli has these observations.
Look, I normally find it hard to get worked up about TV's so-called anniversaries. The 100th episode of L.A. Law, the 200th episode of Cheers, the 300th episode of Dallas. I mean, if the networks didn't keep count and make their little retrospective specials, who else would care? But the 10th anniversary of American Playhouse is something really worth celebrating. As a TV anthology show, it pioneered new ways of presenting programs and raising money, all to keep its own artistic vision going. Some of its dramas, like Testament and Stand and Deliver, premiered in movie theaters before coming to PBS. Others were co-produced with cable networks or foreign companies, which helped reduce costs without reducing the scope of each program. And what programs? True West, Concealed Enemies, Who Am I This Time?, A Walk in the Woods, The Thin Blue Line. So many that it's presented more TV masterpieces in 10 years than Masterpiece Theater has in 20. And yet American Playhouse is starting its 10th season not by reliving past triumphs, but by presenting two new ones. Into the Woods is a wonderful musical that transfers almost perfectly to television. The whole family will enjoy it, though adults will be more affected and unsettled by the less fairy tale second half. The original cast, including Bernadette Peters as the witch, has the material down cold. And even the minor numbers are a joy, like the one where Robert Westenberg and Chuck Wagner play charming princes singing of their new true loves, Cinderella and Rapunzel.
Am I not sensitive, clever, well-mannered, considerate, passionate, charming, as kind as I'm handsome and heir to a throne?
You are everything maidens could wish for.
Then why no?
Do I know?
The girl must be mad.
You know nothing of madness.
till you're climbing her hair and you see her up there as you're nearing her, all the while hearing her agony, misery, though it's different for each. Always 10 steps behind, always 10 feet below, and she's just out of reach. Agony that can cut like a knife. I must have her to want.
American Playhouse's second offering, The Grapes of Wrath, is for adults only, but it's just as impressive, entertaining, and unforgettable. It stars Gary Sinise in the Henry Fonda role of Tom Joad. Sinise, who starred with John Malkovich in the 1984 American Playhouse version of True West, is brilliant. And so is Lois Smith, who plays Ma Joad. And their scenes together, as they try to survive in the cruel world of the Depression, are quietly beautiful.
Tom, what do you aim to do?
What Casey done?
But they killed him.
Yeah. He didn't duck quick enough. He wasn't doing nothing against the law, Ma. I've been thinking a hell of a lot, thinking about our people living like pigs. Good, rich land laying fallow, or maybe there's one fellow with 1 million acres while 100,000 good farmers is starving.
So far, these are the best TV dramas I've seen all season. But for American Playhouse, the season is just beginning.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Post. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with assistance from Roberta Shorrock, Joan Tuohy, and Sue Spolin. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. For Terry Gross, I'm Frank Browning.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, Mario Van Peebles talks with us about his new movie, New Jack City. Also, cockroaches, big scary moths, and a naked mole rat. We talk with biologist and bug wrangler Ray Mendez. That and more on the next Fresh Air.